I'm Éanann Ilona. I know lots about Irish wildlife, and mine is the female voice on Mooney Goes Wild.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Terry Flanagan gives us an update on the mute swan families on the Royal Canal and in Blessington Street Basin. Niall Hatch and Dr. Stephen Newton of Birdwatch Ireland tell us why it's important to eradicate rats from our seabird colonies. And it's the end of an era, as I discover when I speak with marine biologist Emma Ridley about Super Diego, the Galapagos Islands' most amorous giant tortoise.
This is Emma Ridley. I'm a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands. I've been living here for the last 25 years. I work on a couple of ships in the islands, taking visitors around this beautiful place, including the captive breeding program of the giant tortoises, which is where, for the last 25 years, we've been visiting an individual known as Super Diego.
Or you can text right now about anything at all to 51551. But if you could keep it botanical today, we would really appreciate it, because we've got two botanists here. Aidan Elan is here in studio, as is Dr. Matthew Jebb, director of the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. Matthew, great to see you. How are you keeping?
Very well indeed.
Very good. I see you've got your hands very close to your side over there. You're keeping them off the desk.
Exactly. We're keeping ourselves well isolated from one another.
Listen,
is
the Botanic Gardens open?
We have been open for the last 5 weeks. So we did close down for a sort of 5 or 6 week period. And as that timetable was constantly altering and flexible, you know, it was a difficult time. Everybody is anxious, but we had the gardeners back in and they've been minding the plants. So when we opened, it has been more than satisfactory. We established a one-way system.
Oh, very good.
So if you visit the gardens, you know, it's a very pleasing sensation. There's nobody coming towards you. You're all going in one sort of flow. So I'm hoping that will, you know, keep everybody through the summer.
And can you walk in, or do you have to have a booking, like the way for
not at all. It's open to all comers. Now, we will restrict entry if large crowds start to appear, but so far I think it's going to work well. Once you're inside, there's a lot of space and people can spread out.
Well, it's great to hear it. Now, you've got several stories for us today, and the first one is bees that bite the plants that feed them. Tell me more.
Well, one of the interesting things about the drought, a lot of people who are vegetable gardeners will know that if your little lettuces and cabbages get too dry, they immediately start flowering. They bolt into flowers, which is very frustrating. So you've got to keep up a good watering regime. Now, one of the extraordinary things that was spotted just very recently, so this publication appeared 1 month ago. Entomologists in Switzerland were doing experiments with bumblebees, and they noticed the bumblebees were biting the leaves of the plant. And they thought, that's very odd. You know, has that ever been reported before? And then they realised that the bitten plants were flowering 16 days to 30 days earlier than normal. And what they did with various little manipulations experiments, if you starve bees, so you keep them in an enclosure where they can't get flowers and pollen, they start to attack the plants and bite little holes in them, and this causes them to flower much sooner. So they are manipulating the plants. They're acting like little farmers to encourage the flowers into flowering a month earlier.
So has this been... No, the bees are?
The bees are doing this.
Not the actual gardeners?
Not the gardeners. They're behaving like little gardeners. So these bees... Nobody had noticed this before, and that is the really astonishing thing. And they've realised that three species of bumblebee were doing this. They were biting tomatoes and other plants that they were keeping in the enclosure with them. Every time they were starved of pollen and nectar, they would attack these plants, pierce little holes in them. Now,
And they weren't eating the lumps of the leaves.
They weren't eating them, but the biologist said, right, well, let's mimic this. We'll take a scalpel and cut little holes in the leaves of the plant. And sure enough, that stress caused the plants to flower earlier, but not as early as the bee-bitten ones.
So do the bees actually secrete something?
They think they must inject something. They haven't spotted what it is yet. But what is extraordinary is that a biological phenomenon, as simple as that, that you and I could see, oh, look, there's a bee biting a hole in a leaf.
Well, Aina Nilana was talking about that last week to Niall Hatch, remember? Didn't you say the bees were eating his plants? Do you remember?
Biting
his plants.
The leaves.
The bees.
Well,
yeah,
they certainly...
Did you not say that last week?
I didn't.
You did? I'll have to get the tip. What was it?
Bees have been known to
nearly
bite
sure
into,
of it, Aina. I'll have to check the audio.
Yes, indeed.
They've been known to bite into flowers to steal the nectar because it's easier than putting your nose all the way up a flower. You just bite the base of a flower and steal the nectar that way. So bees have been known to do this for centuries.
And then hummingbirds do it as well. And it's mad behaviour. It might have been mentioned in the hummingbirds biting the backs of the flowers because it's a hiding to nothing. Because if they don't...
Well, we couldn't have been because we don't have hummingbirds here. We've got hummingbird hawk moths, but we don't have the hummingbirds here. It was definitely bees. No, definitely.
Very deep nectar. So the nectar's down such a long tube. If your tongue's not long enough, you realise, well, you're going to just cheat and cut into the
nectar. You stick your head in, and then if you can do it around the back. But then if the thing doesn't get pollinated, it's not going to have a flower at all, and then you're not. The whole thing is on a hiding to nothing. We saw those actually, remember, Derek, when we were in the rainforest.
Costa Rica.
Looking at that. But these bees biting the leaves are mad because... You know, if they're just doing it and they don't eat the leaves because they're looking for nectar. Grown-up bees eat nectar and they want pollen for their baby bees. So if they've no nectar and then they just start munching the leaves and then the plant says, yeah, we'll flower early.
We'll give you your nectar and pollen early. And that is quite extraordinary. I mean, it is...
a whole month early.
It's beautiful to think that there are things in nature still to be seen as simple as that, but also as remarkable as that, that bees are actually manipulating plants to produce...
Ordinary bumblebees, the same species we get in Ireland. And are they female bees mostly? Because
they're all the female workers. So Darwin, interestingly, did a huge amount of work on what he called humblebees rather than bumblebees. He used to go out with his children. All six of his children were involved in that research with him. They used to pay them sixpence to...
Yeah, they stood by the flowers and they put... They actually put flour, as in white dust, on the bees, and then they watch where they went next, and they counted how many flowers they visited in a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes, and this is what they did. And of course, bees have to visit a huge amount of flowers, and the bees know, apparently, because we were discussing this another time, whether the flower has already been visited by another bee, because no point in sticking your head in if somebody else has drunk all the nectar.
And do you know how they do that?
Something to do with electromagnetics.
That's right. When they're buzzing their little wings at 200 beats a second, they become positively charged. They've lost all their electrons. But flowers are negatively charged. And as they approach a flower, they can see that if a flower is very negatively charged, it hasn't been visited by a bee for several hours, so it will have nectar. And if a bee has touched down, sucked the nectar out of it, it's lost its charge. So they don't even have... As they get close, they feel, no doubt, a bristling of their little furry hairs, and they say, well, someone's had the nectar here, and on they fly.
And on they fly. And all of this in 6 weeks?
It's extraordinary what they will learn to do. And what really struck Charles Darwin was that bees the next year and the year after used to follow the same flight paths. How did they learn a flight path that doesn't exist? That bee never encountered the other bee from the season before, but it seemed that bees followed the same flight paths around trees, through hedges, year after year after year.
How does the cuckoo find its way to Africa?
This is not even born
in the nest of another cuckoo. And yet it still knows how to get back to Africa. Never met a cuckoo, indeed, yeah. But back to the horticulturalists and this particular bumblebee that's biting the leaves and making the flowers flower earlier. Are the horticulturalists now going to use this to their advantage?
They already do, because a lot of tomato growers introduce these little colonies of cultured bees. They're bumblebees, and you buy the little bumblebee nests and you put them into your tomato house, and the bumblebee stays in the glasshouse and pollinates your crop. Because one of the extraordinary things about tomatoes is they require something called buzz pollination. So a bee has got to land on a flower, and what she does is she lands, she then unhooks her muscles, and she buzzes, a high-pitched buzz. So you'll hear the bumblebee going bzzz. It lands on the flower. Bzzz. And that causes all the pollen to tumble out of the anthers. So this is an amazing ability that bumblebees have evolved, that when they land on a flower, they buzz their muscles, and it causes the pollen just to drop off and attach itself to their bodies. So they are harvesting the pollen by using, it's C sharp is the actual note that they sing, 270 hertz.
Anyway,
yes,
the leaf cutting bee, yes. I know what it is now.
Go on, yeah.
It was a leaf cutting bee, which is a solitary bee. It's not a bumblebee. Yes.
Oh. No, but I knew it was a bee. Yeah, I just couldn't remember.
You were quite right.
Thank you, Anna.
We were talking about him.
I think it's the first time in 25 years you've actually said that to me.
That you were right.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, the 25 probably won't say it again. But anyway, I must be old age creeping up on me. But the leaf cutter bee actually cuts lumps out of leaves, takes the lumps of leaves away with them and brings them back to the nest as part of the nest building.
Yes,
and
yes.
Food that they, so that was a different bee to the bumblebee. You're right, it was a bee, but it wasn't the bumblebee. It was a leaf cutter
bee. But it was a bee nonetheless.
It was a bee nonetheless.
And we did discuss it last. Even I thought I was losing my mind. Matthew, stay with us if you would, Anna. And please, if you have a question, try keep it botanical today. Text 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
We're all on a journey to brighter days that lie ahead. At Toyota, our journey started more than 20 years ago with a dream of a cleaner, better way to drive. Now, Toyota self-charging hybrids cut thousands of tons of CO2 from our atmosphere thanks to Ireland's Toyota hybrid drivers who've made the switch. So harmful emissions will be lower and the days ahead even brighter. Toyota. Built for a better world.
I'd always dreamt of having children, but unfortunately things didn't go as we'd planned. After a year or so of trying, it turned out we needed help. We went to Beacon Care Fertility. They're experts in cutting-edge IVF and genetic screening, so we knew we'd be in safe hands. We could never thank them enough. Beacon Care Fertility, where science meets life.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
You can text us now about anything at all to 51551, but try and keep it plant-related if you could, given that we have Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in studio with us today alongside Anna Launa. Now, tomorrow night, before we continue with today's programme, I want to remind you, you have a second chance to hear a documentary from the Mooney Goes Wild archive, and it is the turn of the Dipper, Ireland's only true aquatic songbird. I hope I'm right in saying that. Anyway, in this clip, you'll hear Professor John O'Halloran of UCC, along with Pat Smiddy. Together, they have been studying this bird for over three decades now.
We're back in the Onachar. Year number 30 or thereabouts, I guess.
Oh, yes. 1983 was the first year that I came to this river.
But obviously we're here now at the beginning of yet another breeding season for dippers. It's just fantastic. These birds are just amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're unique. As a passerine bird, they're unique in that they're being the only species that, you know, swims and dives for its daily living.
And they don't have webbed feet, of course, like a lot
of these
diving
birds. No, they don't. They're perching birds, but they're very well able to swim and dive, very well insulated and really superbly adapted to living in an aquatic environment.
Oh, it's a truly beautiful bird. It really is. I think my favourite bird, that beautiful chocolate brown colour and the white bib, and it's bobbing up and down in clear streams. Oh, there's nothing like seeing, but honestly, nature is just beautiful. Anyway, that's tomorrow night right here on RT Radio 1. So back to today. For the last 6 weeks, I have been telling you about the swans that have been raising their young in Blessington Street Basin, and just a few hundred metres away, the swans that got attacked on the Royal Canal. Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry.
That's right, Derek. 6 weeks ago, you mentioned the six baby swans with their proud mum on their first swim in Blessington Street Basin.
I did.
And we've had regular updates since then. Well, today, I just want to reflect on the progress of this family.
Good.
And also on a pair of swans that we spoke about here on the programme that have set up home on the Royal Canal, which couldn't be more than half a kilometre from the basin. If you're interested, we're talking about that stretch of water just behind the prison. Now here, the pair who built the nest were viciously attacked by a dog and as a result deserted the nest. And we don't know if any eggs were laid at this stage. But we can be sure that if these swans went to the trouble of expending all this energy, their intention was to lay eggs and to raise a family. Now, one of our listeners, John Seary, who lives close to the canal, has been feeding us with information about this pair. And he told us that they moved upstream and built another nest. But let me stress that we can't be certain that it is the same pair, but it would be highly unusual that another pair would move into this territory. Anyway, caveats out of the way, John Seary has filed another report.
Hi Derek, this is John again in Phibsborough. The good news is I've walked by the Royal Canal this afternoon and what appears to be the same swan that I reported a few weeks ago that had been attacked by a dog. So first of all, it's great news to see that same swan, but also it seems that since that attack, that same swan had nested. And today it's great to see that same swan has now had a cygnet. The first thing that springs to mind is it normal for a swan to continue nesting after such an attack, given all the stress I would presume the swan was under? And secondly, is it also normal just to have one cygnet from a brood? I noticed the nearby park in Blessington Street, there are 6 cygnets from one swan. So I'm just wondering, is this normal, or what would you like to say about it, or is there any particular comment on that?
Thank you, John. So just one cygnet here, Terry?
Correct.
And what about the cygnets in Blessington Street Basin?
Well, 6 very healthy looking cygnets, but just one adult, the female. The male, he appears to have gone AWOL.
Oh dear.
I spoke to another Mooney Goes Wild listener, Ben McArdle, who lives just outside the side entrance to the basin.
Well, Terry, we've lots of different types of ducks. Yeah. You know, mallards, we have some mandarin ducks, wood ducks. We did have pintails, I haven't seen them recently.
See the coots there and the moorhens?
We have coots and moorhens, and this year a lot of them have little ducklings as well.
It's so lovely to see them, isn't it?
It's gorgeous, yeah. There's quite a few this year. Actually, in previous years, there wasn't so many. And I believe that was due to a kind of unwanted wildlife here, which weren't the terrapins.
And look what's coming up to us now. We can see the swan, just the one adult swan, and 6 cygnets.
6 cygnets, yeah. So we're all delighted this year that there's such a good, healthy family of swans. 6 is really exciting. So,
but there's no daddy.
No daddy, yeah, no daddy. We don't know what happened to the daddy. You know, as you probably know, swans, they're very protective parents in the early days, but there comes a time where they want their offspring to fly the nest, and they give them a great encouragement to fly the nest. And that's what the father was doing. He was kind of getting rid of last year's cygnets, yeah, who were big enough to fend for themselves, to make way for the new ones. And he chased off the last of last year's cygnets, and he hasn't been seen since himself. So but we don't know what happened.
But she's carrying on the tradition here, because she's laid eggs and they've hatched and they seem to be doing really well. And look at that man there, he's actually feeding them.
Yeah, yeah, and I see he's giving them some good healthy food as well, which is great. He seems to be feeding them peas and spuds, I think he has there.
Which, lettuce or something like that, rather than just throwing them bread.
No, I don't think bread is too good for them. And to be fair, people are great. They're really getting the message that bread isn't good for ducks and swans, but you know.
Now, this has just left me with so many questions, Terence.
Me too. And who better to answer them than our own Dr. Richard Collins?
Let's start with John there, Richard. Why do you think there's only one cygnet this time?
Well, that's possible, Terry, because remember, it's a replacement clutch. And replacement clutches are kind of last-ditch efforts to get some credit for the summer, you see. So replacement clutches are always, almost invariably, smaller than the original clutch. It's also quite late in the season. The biggest clutches tend to be very early on, early April, late March, middle March even in some cases, and they get smaller as the summer wears on. Now at this time of year you'd expect about 5 eggs, but it's a replacement clutch, remember. The fact that she did it at all is remarkable, you know, because she has to get up to a particular weight. She's had a trauma. After all, the dog attack in the first nest depleted her resources a lot. But she has enough resources to form a new egg. And that's the important thing. And she's brought it off, which is very good, really.
And can I take it from that then that replacement clutches and second families, they tend to be less successful?
Well, possibly. Now, the trouble with this is that it's hard to measure these kind of things. The number of replacement clutches I've come across has been quite small. It's laying fewer eggs late in the season because the chances of bringing them off successfully are lower, you see. So the swan's body is going to take account of whether she can successfully do it or not in the time available and the resources available. Remember, bringing off one is an awful lot easier than bringing off six.
Well, that's our swan and cygnet on the canal, but a couple of hundred metres away on the Blessington Street Basin, we've another family of swans. But there's no male. He hasn't been seen at all. Now, what about imprinting, Richard? We spoke on the programme a couple of weeks ago about imprinting, and in this case, there's only a female present. So how is that going to work?
Well, it'll work perfectly well, Terry, because imprinting should take place 16 to 30 hours after hatching. And at that stage, the babies encounter only the female. Daddy's normally out on the water, patrolling up and down, keeping dangers away. It's only later that he begins to associate with them or develop a relationship with his babies. So they'll be safe enough. They're imprinted on Mammy Swan, and that will serve them later on.
Am I right in saying that when it's time for the young to move on, when it's time for them to leave home, that it's the developing white colour that forces the male to drive the young away? And if this is the case, then if there is no male, would the young birds stay with the mother?
Well, now, if you take things forward to a few months from now, remember, if there's no male present, she's not clearing the decks for next year's clutch because she's not going to have a mate and she's not going to produce any eggs. So the situation is different. So she may still be quite aggressive towards white birds on her territory. She takes on some of the characteristics of the male when he's away. For instance, later in the season when he loses his flight feathers, she becomes very aggressive. So this same male behaviour comes out in the female. So she has options next year. She can tolerate them on until she gets a new mate, in which case he'll send them packing, or else she can drive them out to clear the deck anyway.
Is there any danger of her mating with her offspring?
There is, actually. I've come across several cases of sons who return and oust their father and daughters who return and oust their mother from the original territory. But remember, that's a few years down the line. That won't happen next summer, for instance. They'll be 3-4 years of age before they attempt that. But I have seen it happen. These strange liaisons do occur.
And what do you think will happen to this female after the young have gone?
Well, she'll wait around for the male, who won't come back if he's dead, as we assume he is. And then she will head off to a flock location, probably, in all probability, where she will find another partner. Now, of 15 widowed females that I tracked during my study, 14 had a new partner within 3 years. Now, on the male side, I had a similar number of male widowers. Now, they were rather slower to form new attachments. They were usually 5 years or so before most of them had female partners. Now, the reason is, I think, that they're the territory owners and they don't want to surrender the territory. So they can't go back to the ballroom of romance where there are lots of female swans where they can take up with new ones. They do eventually get around to it. Maybe a female will happen by and join them and be accepted. That does happen. Watch this space, Terry.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed, Richard and Terry Flanagan. Lots of text messages coming into 51551. Matthew, we've given you some of the questions. Would you like to start, please, if you would, Matthew Jeff from the Botanic Gardens?
Brian has texted in saying, I was in Kilmacurra last year and noticed that a man kitted out like a spaceman was spraying Roundup. When questioned, he replied they did it all the time to control weeds. Is this also the practice in Glasnevin? Well, Brian, I can say yes, it is, but the quantities we use are the absolute minimum. So I know precisely how much Roundup we used in Glasnevin last year, and it was 7.5 litres for the entire year. Now, I would regard that as a very, very appropriate quantity when used in the right manner. So yes, it is correct that we would regard Roundup as last resort herbicide, but it is the last resort herbicide And we have already removed something like 30 other pesticides we used to use. We no longer use them.
What do you use Roundup on? Is it tap-rooted weeds?
It's mostly for controlling annual weeds in our nursery areas where we're preparing for plantings. And so it is a preparatory process. And it's to do with the amount of people you've got. Yes, you could use hose the whole time. Herbicides in an appropriate way is the most important thing to us. So, you know, the quantities we use, I would be happy to stand by the horticultural need for it. But of course, we are reducing it all the time. We have been doing several experiments this year, actually looking at alternatives. And those are things that we constantly want to progress.
And what are the alternatives, Matthew? I'm curious because as I drive around Dublin and walk around Dublin, I can see what we would traditionally call as weeds everywhere.
Yes.
If you stand long enough, they'll grow out of you.
They will.
Because there's little or no spraying going on, or it appears to be the
case.
And
one of the things we're using now is, or investigating, is blow torches, literally to burn plants off. The trouble with almost every other herbicide is the length of time it lives in the soil. And whilst Roundup, the glyphosate, used to be regarded as quickly degraded in soils, we know it isn't now. And so, you know, we have taken a great deal more care compared to the past, and it is something we need to remove almost.
Okay, we'll leave this blowtorch to the side there. What else are you doing? What can we do at home?
Acetic acid. And again, it burns plants off, but it just doesn't last. I mean, the simple fact is, if there were easy, non-toxic herbicides that were easily
obtained, we'd be doing it.
We would be doing it. Someone would be selling it. And the answer is there isn't. I think, you know, legislation will eventually cause glyphosate and things to disappear or be used in small quantities. And that's all a good thing. I mean, compared to the old days when we would have had huge quantities of chemicals, those have really disappeared. It came on the scene in the 1950s, 60s, and we realised our errors in the 70s and 80s.
So we've made progress.
We've made a lot of progress in removing these chemicals.
Aina.
Yes, I have an email here. I have several, but this one is from Tobias in Chanagarry. I have a small lean-to glasshouse with tomatoes and they have flowered. Do I leave the door open for the bumblebees for pollination? Yes, you do. Otherwise, how are you going to get the bumblebees in? You have to leave the door open and they go in and they go out and they'll do this. But here's another one, and it says, our roadside verges are being cut mechanically almost all the year round. Are we in danger of losing our less distinctive flora, such as groundsel vetch, while dog daisies and poppies are artificially sown from seed packets in flower beds? Please comment. Well, first of all, there's more enlightened approach now to cutting roadside verges than there used to be. And while they cut maybe a little strip in lots of places just for people walking, the whole verge isn't being cut as frequently as before. And dog daisies and poppies actually will only grow along the roadsides the first year. So if you've got a motorway or something and you have a new embankment and the soil has been disturbed, you get your dog daisies and your poppies. And then even if there's never cut, never spray, never anything, they're only a 1 or 2 year job, because after that then the other things like the groundsels and the other vetches will come in then, because there's actually a succession. That was why the poppies on Flanders Fields, the poppies grow, because they dug all the grounds for burying all those soldiers, broke open the soil, and up came the poppies just 1 year. So that's what that comes from. So yes, there's a more enlightened approach to mowing. So, like, you know, then that has to be welcomed.
All right, text 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Whether you love watching big cats in your favourite wildlife show or small cats in funny cat videos, if you watch them on a TV, then you must have a TV licence. It's the law. That's just one of the terms and conditions of life in Ireland. So get yours at tvlicense.ie or at any post office. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
Need a new car or van, but not sure if now is the right time? Ford's Peace of Mind promotion can give you just that. We'll defer any Ford options or higher purchase payments for the first 3 months. You can also save up to €2,500 and get our outstanding 7-year warranty across our range of new cars. Or save up to €6,500 on a new commercial vehicle with a 5-year transit warranty. Search Peace of Mind on Ford.ie for full details.
Register by July 31st. Finance is provided by way of a higher purchase agreement. Please note that a deferred payment will result in a higher cost of credit. The credit provider is Bank of Ireland Leasing Limited, trading as Ford Credit. Lending criteria conditions apply. Ownership remains with Ford Credit until the final payment is made.
Get involved in National Heritage Week 2020. Develop a project that explores the theme of learning from our heritage with your family, community or organisation. Research heritage on your doorstep. Share or relearn a heritage skill or find out more about Ireland's history of education. Projects will be showcased online during National Heritage Week in August. National Heritage Week is a programme of the Heritage Council, supported by the local authorities, Heritage Officers Network, the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, OPW and Foil to Ireland. Visit heritageweek.ie.
RTE, supporting the arts.
The wait is finally over and sport is back on Now TV.
It's lights out and away we go!
Where you can watch Sky Sports, Premier Sports and BT Sport together and all without a contract.
What a fantastic part.
So whether there's a day, week or whole month of action you just can't miss, you can now stream the lot.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is your sport on your terms. Search Now TV Sports to find out more. 18 plus content streamed via internet. Full terms apply.
Email mooney@rte.ie.
Now, we talk a lot about birds on this programme, especially in springtime. Think of the dawn chorus where the garden birds are actively setting up territory and finding mates. Well, this is the time of year when seabird nesting season is in full swing. Ireland is home to some of Europe's most important breeding seabird colonies on cliffs, beaches and islands all around our coast. The birds have a lot to contend with: climate change, commercial overfishing and human disturbance, for example. But one of the biggest threats they face comes from non-native predators such as mink, mice and especially rats. Yes, rats. Niall Hatch is with Dr. Stephen Newton of Birdwatch Ireland in Kilcool to tell us more about this, let's say, unsavoury story. Niall.
Unsavoury indeed. Yeah, not everyone likes to talk about our furry friends or our furry enemies, as the case may be.
Indeed.
I'm here in Kilcool, County Wicklow, with my Birdwatch Ireland colleague, Dr. Stephen Newton, who's our seabird conservation guru. And I just wanted to check with Steve to find out what's going on at Ireland's important world-class seabird colonies, and particularly in relation to the problem of rats, because we have an issue with rats on Irish islands. Unfortunately, they eat the eggs and the chicks of the seabirds because they have no defence against them. So it's an ongoing battle. Of course, we're in the middle of the seabird breeding season at the moment, when those eggs and chicks are very, very vulnerable, and it's something that really has to be tackled. So Steve, what are we doing about this and what's going on at the moment?
Okay, well, I think we need to wind back a little bit and talk about the bigger global perspective. But certainly over the last 200 or 300 years of man's moving around the planet and discovering new lands, he's been taking furry friends and other things with him as he travels. And these invasive, what turn into invasive predators, have been responsible for 87 bird extinctions that we know about so far. And then of those 87, 52 can be attributed to rats, of one of three species that are globally quite abundant. So this is a key issue. It mostly affects islands, but that's possibly where we see the problem more. And obviously, islands are where seabirds tend to nest, because by and large, most of the other big or middle-sized carnivorous mammals aren't present. So man has been bringing rats and cats, and in the case of Australia, a very big island, it's brought foxes, and New Zealand has stoats. These are all non-native predators that become invasive when their populations build up, and they certainly start targeting the real native fauna and flora.
And in Ireland, how big a problem is this, and which islands are particularly of concern to you at the moment?
We haven't actually ever done a comprehensive review of the status of rats on all islands. We're beginning to think we ought to do this. We, in our travels, particularly looking at seabirds, have got to most Irish islands. I wouldn't say all of them, and certainly we follow in Major Rutledge's footsteps there, but we certainly know that virtually all islands within a couple of miles of the shore are almost certainly going to have rats or mice, house mice, present on them.
So how do you go about removing the rats, getting rid of them from the islands, without hurting any of the other wildlife, and especially the seabirds that you're protecting?
Well, that's the key to the whole issue, is to do it without impact on other species. So we have to be very, very careful. And I mean, it's not a popular subject, sort of killing one species to protect another one. But remember, rats weren't present in Ireland from the kickoff, so it's a species that has followed man onto the mainland and out onto the islands. And I say virtually all islands on the east coast and a lot on the west coast have rats on them. The likes of Rockabill, being whatever it is, about 6 kilometres offshore, we think has protected it. It's not a very hospitable place unless you're a tern. You know, it's a tiny little island rock with, thankfully, no rats at the moment, but the inshore islands in Skerries, Lambay, Islands Eye, Dorky, Saltese all have rats of one or two species.
So what do you do to actually safeguard the other wildlife and especially the seabirds?
It's really, yes, okay, we have to get to the nuts and bolts of it. We do have to poison them. It seems to be the most humane, is not a great word, but we try and do it the best way we can. It certainly does involve the death of the rodents, I'm afraid. But it's how we deploy the poison, that it has to be in a way that only the rats, and maybe if mice were present, they would be able to access it. But we'd be very worried about any other species, particularly the scavengers and carnivores, that would be interested in any novel food. The likes of crows of all shapes and sizes are likely to try their hand. They're very intelligent, they know something's going on, and they find something edible in them. So basically, we are putting the bait into containers that we are fairly sure only rats or mice could get at. And we back this up by, in a lot of cases, we would have trail cameras watching what goes on to make sure that other species are not accessing the bait station, as we call them, which technically can be a black box with a little tunnel in it through which the rats can enter to access the food. Or we sometimes use long meter-long lengths of drainage pipe of about 5 centimetres diameter, just big enough for a rat, but not much else. Hopefully it would keep rabbits and other things out. So it's really careful deployment of the bait in areas where we think rats like to go. And then we monitor very, very closely. And obviously we're searching the islands all the time to see if there is any collateral damage. But generally speaking, we've been very successful. We get occasional cases where if an island is grazed by cattle or goats or sheep or something, they can start showing an interest and start kicking the things about. And if they start kicking them around, then sometimes the bait could come out. But basically, we would fix the bait inside the centre of the bait station so nothing else can really get it except a little furry animal with 4 legs.
And how successful is this, Steve? And what sort of bait do you use? And once you do it, is it job done when you've eradicated the rats from an island, or do you have to keep doing it?
Well, eradication is usually attempted in the middle of winter when all other sources of food are presumed to be at their lowest. So there's no point trying to do it during the middle of the breeding season because there's so many failed eggs, dead chicks, dropped fish, whatever it is around the island, let alone all the vegetation and other seafood. So we tend to do it in the middle of winter, starting October, November-ish, and working through the winter. We use what are called the second generation rodenticides, which are a fairly toxic substances that cause internal hemorrhaging in the rodents. A lot of people get very upset about this, but bear in mind, a lot of people do this around their homes and businesses, and particularly food premises on the mainland. So it's a practice that's very tightly regulated. You need lots of licenses from the Department of Agriculture to be able to lay poison out. So we have to be very careful. If we do it right, you can, and there are lots of amazing cases across the world where rats have been removed from very significant seabird colony islands. It's one thing we haven't really done to any great degree in Ireland. National Parks and Wildlife Service are hoping to start an eradication project on Great Saltee for the benefit of the seabirds there, some of which are very threatened by the rats, of which puffins would be the most famous. There's only a handful left on the island. So it's really important that this work is done. We know everybody isn't happy with it, but, you know, conservation involves an awful lot of things and tough decisions that have to be made to preserve these species. And we are only trying to uphold Irish and European law in doing this.
Absolutely. I know that these tough decisions do have to be made, and it's very tricky, but the survival of these species is in the balance, and so we have to make these difficult decisions. Thanks very much, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to let you know what's going on there in the seabird world. You know, please call again through the summer and find out how things progress.
Back to you in the studio, Derek.
Thank you very much indeed, Niall. Still lots of text messages coming. And don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney, to catch up on anything we're discussing in today's programme, or visit a very extensive archive which goes back many, many years. As you've heard, we're on the programme on the air for the last 25 years. I'm after misplacing one. Oh, yeah. Aina mustn't live in Dunleary Rathdown, says Pat. Almost all verges have been cut really short, even where those signs are that say wildlife area, do not cut or spray. Very disappointing, says Pat.
You have to go out and lie down in front of the mowers like a proper demonstrator does. Lie down in front of the tanks. Yeah, well, you see, this is the thing. Sometimes there's different policies involved. You know, it's a wildlife area, but that's been managed by one section of the council, and then there's the mowers with the other section. But presumably, negotiation, talking to the fellas who are driving the mowing machines would be a start.
I'm not sure nobody talks to anybody in this country, do they? Well, weeds can be killed using boiling water. It perishes the roots. Great on the patio, says Monica, who lives in Ace. And this one, Matthew, I'm afraid it's not very complimentary, but that's at right. Any rate, will I read it or will I?
Read it out.
I don't upset you.
I'm happy to take it.
Okay. Yeah. Just for the record, Matthew is the director of the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. It says, why is there a horticultural need for Roundup? I'm absolutely appalled that the bots, which is what the Botanic Gardens are short known as, uses that god-awful stuff, stick to vinegar, whether they come back or not, says Mary. So justified.
Well, you're right, Mary. Of course this is a problem, but we always have to remember that gardening is not dealing with nature. It's an artificial thing we're
it's
doing.
It's an unnatural practice. That's what it is.
And it's difficult. And in order to try and make things look pleasing and nice to the eye, yes, we have to use all sorts of tricks and steam, as Monica said in her text there. There are various sort of steam machines. They look a bit like a sort of modern day Hoover, but they're spraying steam
onto the
ground.
But they don't cook the earthworms.
Well, there's always going to be somebody who will suffer at the hands of one of these things. And Mary is right. Yes, we should try vinegar, and we have trialled it, but the results were very disappointing. And I would stand by again that we use it as a last resort. If you go to the bots and you look at those huge herbaceous borders, all of the weeds in there have been hand dug. So one of our gardeners, with the assistance of a second gardener, spent the entire winter digging out one side and picking out the weeds. It was hundreds and hundreds of hours. And, you know, that is really the best.
So you use it sparingly?
I mean, 7 litres a year, I would be very happy to boast that that's an incredibly small quantity that we use.
All right. Mooney, please, how can I stop hordes of seagulls who gather and cause horrific noise on our roofs at 5 a.m. every morning? Thanks, says sleep deprived in the capital of the world, Bray.
Well, the answer is you can't put in earplugs while you're asleep.
Well, it is the breeding season for seabirds, and this is what's happening. You live in, the birds see your rooftop as a man-made cliff. Next week, we'll be discussing this very issue with some of our other listeners. Terry Flanagan is doing an ACE report. So stay tuned for more on that next week.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
We're all on a journey to brighter days that lie ahead. At Toyota, our journey started more than 20 years ago with a dream of a cleaner, better way to drive. Now, Toyota self-charging hybrids cut thousands of tons of CO2 from our atmosphere thanks to Ireland's Toyota hybrid drivers who've made the switch. So harmful emissions will be lower and the days ahead even brighter. Toyota. Built for a better world.
An important message from Transport for Ireland. Public transport services are running for essential travel, with limited seat capacity to allow for social distancing. An enhanced daily cleaning programme is in place, and passengers who can are asked to wear face coverings on board. Please respect priority seating areas, use your TFI Leap card where possible, and avoid unnecessary journeys. Never use public transport if you have any symptoms of COVID-19. Usual timetable schedules may vary. See transportforireland.ie for updates.
I'm 43. We have one dependent, a daughter.
You'll never defeat me.
Yes, I will. Sorry, where were we?
Want to talk pensions while playing table tennis with your daughter? Now you can. Chat from home by video or phone with your financial broker or advisor about retirement planning with Irish Life. It's a smart way to get your pension sorted and really perfect that backhand. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Here's a great item. I know you're going to like it because we were taken this week by the story of Diego, the giant Galapagos tortoise. His fathering prowess is credited with almost single-handedly saving his once threatened species. This report from the BBC.
We're going to take a few moments to pause and look away from the most pressing stories of the day and reflect on a tortoise called Diego. Not just any tortoise, a giant one whose libido has saved his species from extinction, no less. And he's retiring. Here he is in the Galapagos Islands. He's 100, so this retirement's not unreasonable. And scientists estimate that he's fathered up to 900 giant tortoises, which are all alive today. You heard that right, 900. For decades, he's been kept in captivity on Santa Cruz Island as part of a breeding program. Before that, he was in a zoo in San Diego. Now, though, Diego's being returned to where he started off, on a tiny uninhabited island called Española, from which he was taken in the 1920s.
Super Diego's contribution to the breeding program on Santa Cruz Island was particularly noteworthy, where it is believed he fathered about 40% of the 2,000-strong tortoise population. Emma Ridley is a marine biologist based in Santa Cruz. Hello, Emma. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. Can you begin by telling me a little bit about Española Island and why it's important?
Española Island is one of the oldest islands in the Galapagos chain. It is located all the way to the southeast of the archipelago, and it's pretty much a dying island, if you wish. It's no longer active. It's moved away from the hotspot. It's gradually sinking below the waters. And it's very low, flat, rocky island with quite a lot of brush-like vegetation.
And how long have you known, if I can put it like that, Super Diego?
Well, I've been living and working in the Galapagos as a naturalist guide for the last 25 years. And Super Diego has actually been in the captive breeding program since the late 70s. So I've known him for about 25 years.
Why is he so special?
Well, he basically came to a rescue of a tortoise population that really was on the brink of extinction. In the 70s on Española Island, just 12 females and 2 males were found to have survived. And these were brought to the island of Santa Cruz, where a captive breeding program was started. And during a search for other tortoises in private collections around the world, and then this individual male Española tortoise was brought back to the Galapagos from San Diego Zoo, hence the name Diego. The super part of his name he got because he turned out to be a quite prolific breeder. Diego was a particularly active and sometimes quite aggressive with females. So when we visited the captive breeding program, we quite often see him in action. But he is thought to have produced about 900 offspring. So about 40% of the approximately 2,300 young tortoise hatchlings brought back to the island.
And is that a lot? Because I know sea turtles can lay anything up to 100 eggs.
Yes, it's very different. Giant tortoises lay eggs, maybe 6 to, depending on the species, maybe 6 to 10 or even 15 large eggs per nest. So it's a very different breeding strategy to the sea turtles, which actually have to overcome a huge amount of predation to be able to have any hope for survival.
How many would normally make it?
In normal conditions, we'd think probably about 50%. So it's quite high compared to sea turtles.
And they breed fairly late in life, because I know Diego is 100, so you're retiring him from breeding. Was he still breeding last year? Was he breeding this year? When did he start breeding? When did he stop breeding? And did you stop him, or did he stop himself?
Tortoises actually do start breeding relatively late. Depending on the species, about 20 years, they become into sexual maturity, anything between 16 and 26 years of age. And then we don't actually know when they stop, because the trouble with the giant tortoises is that they live so much longer than humans. They probably live about 150 years, maybe more. So to be honest, we have no idea at what age exactly they stopped breeding. Super Diego was still being very active when he was brought back to the field last Monday. So, and we hope he'll continue to produce more offspring in the wild.
Now, poor old Diego has gone into retirement. You've known him, you say, for 25 years or thereabouts. Has he aged much? I mean, can you tell that this tortoise is now 100 and not 75?
Well, he's definitely grown in size since he hatched, of course. But the tortoises have the good luck to hatch wrinkly, and so they don't age. They do have a very kind of slow metabolism, but they don't do much other than eat and breed and sleep long periods of time. So there might be something to be learned from there.
Well, take care of Diego and take care of yourself, Emma, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you very much. It was lovely talking to you.
Yeah.
Matthew, you've been to the Galapagos, haven't you?
I have indeed. Fantastic spot. Just bizarre, that whole sort of world of naive creatures that hop around in branches right by you, happily sitting on their nest when you walk by. It is a truly magnificent place to go.
And have you seen the giant tortoises, or is it the giant tortoise, or how would you say it?
Tortoises.
Tortoises, yeah. Have you seen the giant tortoises?
I've seen one in the wild because they, you know, they're widely spread and plenty in captivity in the breeding captive programs that they've got there, because like there has been explained, that the pressures on those islands from introduced goats and pigs and human beings has led to a catastrophic collapse on a lot of the islands.
Well, it's having a little bit of time to recover right now. Mind you, I'm sure they would love to get the tourist dollar back.
I know, and that is one of the intriguing things. It's very well managed indeed. The Galapagos National Parks have got an incredible system of limiting the number of boats, limiting the times people spend ashore, and some of the islands are impacted. You know, they might be 20 miles across these islands, and there's just three little trails, each 2 kilometres long, and that's it. You're not allowed any further than that.
Now, Jarlath Holland, our broadcast coordinator, has popped into studio to add something to the discussion. Jarlath.
Hiya, Derek. Matthew, I use a mixture of neem oil mixed with water and washing up liquid to control aphids in my back garden. Is that a wise thing to do?
Absolutely. No, I think any of these, I think one of the points of using any pesticide is its persistence in the environment. And something like neem oil, it's an organic product from the neem tree of India. And it has been long used for thousands of years in India for medicinal purposes. And it is, yes, it's toxic. Like anything that's useful medically has got a toxic level, but it's a mild toxin. So it will kill the aphids, but it won't harm a lot of the larger things like birds that might eat some of those aphids that are partly covered with the neem oil. So it's a very sensible organic choice for a pesticide.
Good man, Jarlath. Henry's been on to say maybe it's time to stop using the word weed. What would you say if nature would regard humans as weeds? Well, what else would I call them? I mean,
pests.
No, they're simply plants growing where we don't want them. So some of our own native plants that we would regard as beautiful wildflowers have become weeds in other parts of the world.
Potatoes could be weeds if they're grown in this year's wheat field and last year's potato crop.
It's a term. I mean, oats is a wonderful example of a weed. Oats were never eaten in the Middle East. They arrived here by accident in wheat and barley crops. And then we discovered in Scotland and on the west coast of Ireland, it grew a lot better in a wet summer. We would get a crop of oats. And so they have been the saving, really, of people exposed to sort of Atlantic weather. The oat became the best. And it was a weed initially.
Anyway, Matthew, you are welcoming people into the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin.
We certainly are. We've been open 5 weeks, and I hope people will find it a very conducive and pleasant place. And do not fear that it's full of weed killer, because it isn't. We use it as little as possible, sparingly as possible, and our aim is to practice gardening that is sustainable into the future.
Is it full of ladybugs?
Do you have hand sanitizer at the gate?
No, we don't. We do have lots of hand sanitizer in the buildings, so you can use it there, but we will hope people are nice and clean when they arrive.
Okay,
Matthew, it's full of ladybirds, is it?
There's plenty of ladybirds about, and that was a good thing because they're eating the aphids, and you know they're our front line in pest control.
Matthew, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Ian and Elena. Thanks to Terry. Thanks to Jarlath Holland, our broadcast coordinator. On sound, we had Nikki Dempsey. We had John Riley, our researcher. Thanks to Sheila, one of our producers, came in to help out today. And we'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, visit the website. Bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.